All right, let's do this. How are you? What the fuckers? What the fuck buddies? What the fucking ears? What the fuckocrats? What the fuck publicans? And the what the fuck nicks? Of course, the protest folks. How's it going? What's happening? Did I ever say what the fuckies? Why haven't I not said what the fuckies? I must have said it somewhere. Anyways, how are you? I'm Mark Maron. This is my podcast, WTF. Welcome to it. I hope you're doing okay. Today on the show, Jason Mantzoukas. He's a comic actor, and I didn't know anything about him. I did know things about him. I'd seen him in everything. But then I also know he did the podcast, How Did This Get Made, with Paul Scheer and June Diane Raphael. I knew that. But I didn't know what he would be like. But he's a fucking great guy. Fucking great guy. Nice guy. Solid. Present. And he brought me a gift. So right out of the gate, I was like, wow. This is all good surprises. So he's on the show, Jason Mantzoukas. You'll hear me talking to him in a few. One thing I did want to say right here at the beginning is I know because of GLOW, the Gorgeous Ladies of Wrestling, a show which I am on, and I'm still getting beautiful and very, I'm very grateful for the feedback I'm getting. I had no idea that it would turn out to be so amazing. But there are a lot of new people here listening to this show. So I'd like to invite you. I'd like to invite you to check out the more than 800 episodes in our archives. You can start a Stitcher Premium membership today. You can go to stitcherpremium.com/WTF and then use the code WTF for 20% off. And then you'll have access to, I don't know if you figured it out yet, the most recent 50 are always free. So that means that every episode is up for public consumption for, 6 months. And then they slowly go behind the archive wall, which, as I said, is available at Stitcher Premium, except for the President Obama podcast, which is always available, always evergreen, and always a bit soothing if you're of a certain ilk. So that's there. But I just wanted to give you a heads up because I know a lot of you are new to the show. Some interesting questions coming at me because of my performance in the Netflix series GLOW. One that I seem to get a lot is like, hey man, did you start smoking again? Sam Sylvia, your character is smoking all the time and doing blow. Did you start smoking? Did you want to do some blow? How did it feel to do fake blow? And people ask me, what is the blow made out of? What is that blow? How do they make fake blow? I'm not sure what it is, but I think it was something they added to real blow to make it less real. I think it was one of, I don't know if it's mannitol or sorbitol or one of them. I don't think it's the one that makes you shit, which I think is mannitol, but it definitely is one of the talls, and it's definitely something that they put into, good blow to make it less good blow. So did I want to do blow? After chopping those lines and rolling up that bill and taking it out of my pocket and doing a bump out of the bindle with the top of a big pen. That should be a lyric. I'm doing a bump out of the bindle with the top of my Bic pen. Pow. That was a very mild pow followed by a slight sizzling noise. It would have been much more exciting. But the weird thing is I did not. I was not nostalgic for doing blow. I did not want to do blow. And I did get a little bit of a drip, but it was a very unsatisfying drip. There was no payoff to going There just no payoff, no nummies, no throat nummies, little kind of like secondary auxiliary bump from the collection of Coke goo in the back of your sinuses, nothing like that. It was just the action. It was just the ritual of doing it with no real satisfaction. I believe that the first time I did a little of the fake blow, I did a little placebo jolt from the fake blow. But no, did not have any desire, which is a testament to sobriety and to the understanding of what it is to be powerless over drugs, powerless over alcohol. The knowledge to know that if I do this shit again, it's probably not going to stop for a while. It's not going to be pretty and it's not going to take me anyplace new or good. As for the cigarettes, did not want to smoke cigarettes again. It's amazing how easily that shit comes back to you. It is like riding a bike, riding a a very dangerous bike that, you know, that you doesn't take any physical activity, and eventually just becomes a shitty drain on your life. But yeah, I did not want to smoke. That's partially because I still do nicotine lozenges and I'm kind of buffered from that. So there's the answer to those two questions. If you have more questions about Glow and the character of Sam Sylvia, feel you can email me anytime. So I haven't done this in a while. I'm going to read a couple of emails. This one is for Pride Week. This just says the subject line is Patrice and Gay Stuff. Hi, Mark. First, thank you for being a true voice out there in this sea of bullshit and lies. Second, Pride Month is coming to a close, and I've been reflecting on my own gay shit lately and the people who encouraged me to come out knowingly and unknowingly. Patrice O'Neill was one of those people. My interactions with him were brief but significant. I've heard you mention him often, and so I wanted to place this story out there in the world just to say thank you to him wherever it is we go when we die. When I was in my early 20s and not out, I was an assistant to a comedy manager in New York City. We managed Patrice O'Neill and Bill Burr and a few other folks for a brief period of time. Patrice was brand new and my boss knew he'd be big. Patrice saw me and within 10 minutes, matter-of-factly declared me to be gay. It was innocuous. I can't even remember the context. It may have even been, quote, "So are you going to gay pride?" He took one look at my dewy eyes and well-coiffed hair and knew. I think most people did, but he said it out loud. It wasn't mean. It wasn't hateful. It was just a true, curious observation. I feel no ill will, but it left me stunned, not because I felt attacked, but because I felt accepted, even though I hadn't accepted myself yet. I don't know his politics or how he felt about gays behind closed doors. There may even be tapes of him hating on the faggots. I have no idea. What I do know is that it helped me along in my self-acceptance process, that he could be so nonchalant about something that provided me with so much angst for so many years, gave me a moment to breathe and the courage to take the steps to fully embrace myself. After that, he fully farted in the passenger seat of my 1993 Ford Taurus. It was so bad, I had to do a spot check for possible remnants. This was both the blessing and the curse of driving him to a gig. So I wanted to thank him in some way and figured you could deliver the message. It's been many years that I've been out and proudish. Gays do just as much stupid shit as the rest of us, right? Gays for Trump can suck it hard. That was in parentheses. I have him and other people like him to thank for making the transition much easier. Thanks, man. Keep doing the good work you do. Sincerely, Tom. So, Patrice, if you hear this man, he thanks you. I miss him, man. Patrice was a powerful guy. And, man, yeah, he's one of those guys. Him and Geraldo. Some days I'm just like, fuck. I miss him. I miss running into those guys when I go to New York. We'll get to Jason Mantzoukas in a minute, but I wanted to read one more email. I like this one, too. This one's got a nice narrative arc to it. Subject line, the other man was you, Mark. And when you see that subject line, there's a moment where I'm like, oh, fuck, what did I do? When did I do it? And am I going to get killed? That's what that subject line did to me. The other man was you, Mark. I was completely ready to be like, oh, fuck, I remember that. But I was pleasantly surprised. Here we go. Mark, I have to say my first contact with WTF was shrouded in a curious mystery of who the fuck is this guy and what the fuck does my missus want with him? You see, way back in 2010, my wife and I split and I was staring down the bottle of marriage number two over and done, except different from the first one ending. This time we had a kid to consider. I was dark as all fuck on her for her slight indiscretion, but you know, I had one too that I paid no heed to. I was all about fuck her for this and that. In other words, I was behaving like a typical cuckold ass. But anyway, you came up because after some months of living in separate homes and lives, etc., I asked her what she was up to and if there was anyone she was interested in. She replied casually, "I've been getting into Marin." I asked who the fuck Marin was and she said Mark, and that was that. I was livid. Leaving nothing further explained, I spent a few days fuming on who the fuck this Mark Marin was, and I was all over the who's, what's, where's that we go through when building a mental concept of some fucking guy balling my ex-wife. It wasn't until a week or so later I tentatively approached the subject with her of the new guy when dropping off the little boy, when she said you were on a podcast called WTF and I should check it out. Now you became the guy with a podcast that my ex was riding, and I thought, who's this pretentious twat with a radio show? Anyway, it worked out well as I finally got into checking out the other guy, listening into the podcast, bro, realizing how I'd concocted the whole thing in my big stupid head, and 7 years later, I'm still tuning in weekly. And as it turned out, though my time separated was doused in drink, I was listening to the other guy with similar shit to deal with, and you, Mark, turned out to be the guy who helped me get through it. Thank you for that, Mark. My gorgeous ex and I spent 4 years apart before figuring out we were idiots and got back together, and yes, in some ways you still are the other guys when we are listening in together or watch your stand-up or now watch you on Glow. She turns to me and says, Mark is still my silver fox. Huh? Happy ending. Cheers for the years, man. Sincerely, Fabian. That's from Australia. That's a good story, right? That worked out well. I'm glad. Thanks, pal. Glad to help out. So Jason Mantzoukas, oh, I mentioned that he brought me a gift, but here's the thing, like, I always have people come over and they do these things, they talk to me, and, some of them know the show, some of them have listened to the show because they're going to be on the show, and, occasionally things, people bring me stuff that, they're promoting or whatever, but Jason Mantzoukas, who I've met a couple times, who I do not know, brought me this record. It was a reissue of Mingus, Charles Mingus record. It was a nice piece of wax, nice vinyl record. And I had just gotten the original one that was a little beat up. So this one was sort of like, it was some sort of sign that I had to really get into this. And he knew I was getting into jazz. He knew I was a vinyl guy. He brought me this record that had had meaning to him. And I listened to it and is really one of the greatest jazz records, ever. I texted him after I listened to it twice. I said, it's all here, man. The whole history of the whole thing is on this record. And it was just thoughtful. And it was very nice. And I had no idea what we were going to get into. He's in this new movie, The House, with Will Ferrell and Amy Poehler. It's in theaters tomorrow, June 30th. I knew he was on the podcast, How Did This Get Made? But I didn't know him as a person. And I love talking to him. So this is me and Jason Mantzoukas. Enjoy. You're such a music freak. Do you have a lot of records?
I do have a lot of records. Yeah, I do. I haven't counted them. I don't know how many, but I also did a thing where through the end of college and through the years after college,
yeah,
I went around and just bought people's entire record collections.
Yeah.
So I also have like...
But just people at school? You're just a guy going like, hey, you going home? You taking those
people
records?
People at school, but also just like at yard sales and flea markets, at any place that people were selling stuff. I have probably 478s.
Really?
Just because I bought them all from one person.
Now, wait, do you house them somewhere?
They were up until... yes, Mark, I do right now, unfortunately. Up until a year ago, I still had my apartment in Brooklyn that I kept all this time. And so it all lived there.
Oh, really?
Lived in a Brooklyn apartment. And
so
then,
when people say, can I stay at your apartment? You're like, no.
My records are staying there. All of my records and books are there. That was my big thing when I moved to LA. I was like, no records, no books, clean. I want to live
feels
minimally.
Feels good, doesn't it?
It does. My house is now full of records and books.
It is. Yeah. Not the ones from Brooklyn.
Nope. Although those have now made their way, but they're in a storage locker.
I had to pull back because, the fascinating thing to me is that there was all this stuff. I grew up in a mainstream way, really.
Yep.
So, I had a couple of people in my life that turned me on to things.
Sure.
That were outside of the box, but it was, you don't really realize until like 5 years ago, how small my periphery was.
Sure.
And there's all this other stuff. I may not like it,
yeah,
but there's stuff that...
Exposure for me is huge. I would say one of the most transformative people in my life,
yeah,
truly, was a guy named Steve Barrett, who I started taking drum lessons from in suburban Boston when I was 10 years old.
Yeah.
And I took drum lessons with him until I went to college.
Really?
So, 8-9 years.
Yeah.
One of Steve Barrett's rules for taking drum lessons with him is every week you had to show up with a blank cassette. And over the course of the lesson, he would record two albums for you of hit from his record collection.
So you're at his house?
Always at his house.
Yeah.
And so every week I walked away with music.
Yeah.
And it was...
From age 10.
From age 10. So, but his taste was... So I'm like a 10-year-old being given like... All the King Crimson records, all of 70s progressive rock.
Yeah.
From that to all reggae. He got super into reggae at one point. Right. So I was like a 12-year-old who got obsessed with reggae.
Right.
You know, everything. Yeah. My record collection, what I was digesting was so diverse. It was crazy.
Now, when you were doing that, so you wanted to be a drummer.
For sure.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And you can do it. Sure. I imagine you're still good at it.
I'm okay now. Now I'm just fine. You know, I was very good at it for those years, through college. But at in my 20s, I stopped really playing.
So when did you, you grew up where?
Outside Boston.
Which town?
Nahant, Massachusetts.
Nahant.
Nahant's North Shore.
Oh, okay.
It's like
by Marblehead?
Yeah, just before Marblehead. It's like an island off of the coast of Lynn, actually.
Off of Lynn,
Lynn, connected by a causeway.
Oh, right. Yeah. So it's closer to Boston.
Yeah, it's like 7 miles from
than
Boston.
Marblehead.
Yep.
And that's where you're born and raised?
Born in Lynn, technically. We lived in Lynn when I was born, but very quickly moved to Nahant, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I know that area from doing stand-up there. So, what kind of family? What are you?
I'm Greek. I'm Greek in origin. My parents are Greek.
They're all Greek.
Yeah.
They speak Greek?
They do. They do. They
first generation?
My dad, born in Greece, comes over as a kid.
Yeah.
My mom, born here, two Greek parents.
What was the family business?
Family business was my dad worked in healthcare. He worked in hospitals for many years, and then he started his own as a very kind of... immigrant-y kind of entrepreneurial. He owned and operated assisted living facilities and nursing homes in New England, in the Boston area.
Oh, so he's a good-hearted guy.
Great. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Totally. And that's my first jobs were, I worked as the assistant to the handyman in a nursing home. You know, those at age 11, 12, doing painting the railings or whatever.
But you're around a lot of very old people.
Very much. And a lot of old people for a long time.
And it wasn't scary.
No, it wasn't scary. That is that says everything.
Does it?
Yeah. That's it right there. It was good. Interesting thing.
Well, you seem like a well-adjusted person.
I think so.
And do you have brothers and sisters?
I have a younger sister.
Yeah?
Yeah. She lives in Maine, has two kids.
We're in Maine.
She lives outside Portland.
Oh.
Yeah.
So, all right. So you're growing up there.
Yeah.
You're going, Lynn is Lynn, isn't that by Cambridge, really? A little east or
No, it's further north. You're basically going north up through Quincy, Revere, Winthrop, all those
Revere.
Towns.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
Revere basically goes right into Lynn.
How'd you get out without sounding like that?
It pops up. At some point over the rest of the day, you'll be like, there it is. You'll be like, there it is.
The little thing.
There's weird words that I'll say. A lot of them are I'll say popcorn or hot dog.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is a very Boston-y thing. Or it'll come out with the words worry or sorry. Or people will sometimes be like, are you Canadian? And it's really just adjusting around the accent.
Yeah, yeah.
I never, also my parents.
No, I'm fighting Boston.
Yeah. My parents never had solid accents. I didn't grow up in that accent very heavily because both my sets of grandparents spoke Greek or didn't have that accent. And so my parents didn't get it. And so I didn't get it as much. I got it socially.
But... Yeah, yeah, yeah. But I would think in school,
Yeah, yeah, it was certainly there. I could do it.
I'm sure you could do it.
I can do it. But but no, I never had it as heavy.
Yeah.
It really was just certain sounds or certain words. It would be there.
Yeah.
You know?
So when you're going to school there and early on, you're like, I'm going to be a drummer at 10.
Yeah.
That was your decision.
Yeah. Well, my parents said, you have to take lessons in an instrument. You can choose the instrument.
Yeah.
I chose drums.
Yeah.
And loved it and was immediately obsessed with just every element of it.
So you go through high school doing that? No theater, no nothing, no comedy?
No. Comedy in as much. Yes, comedy. No theater, but in junior and senior year, I also, Leslie Stahl, recent guest on your show, I went to Swampscott High School because my town was too small to have a school system beyond like elementary school.
Really?
There was too few kids to support it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Nahant's the smallest town, I think, in Massachusetts. It's like a 1 square mile island.
So you knew everybody?
Oh, beyond. You knew everybody.
Island people. But it's not like Nantucket.
It's not like Nantucket because it's not a vacation spot. It's not a...
But are you really on an island? Is there island mentality? Sort of like a little too insulated?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, no. Very much so. Yeah. It's also much smaller than all those other islands.
Right.
You know, so it's not just small. It's wildly isolated.
Yeah. So you had
it felt like, to me, like as a child... I go back now and it could not be a more idyllic Norman Rockwellian kind of beautiful coastal New England town.
Right.
As a child, it was like a prison.
Right.
It might as well have been like Alcatraz.
But
like out in the middle of the ocean, fuck you.
Why are we
you
here?
Can't go anywhere. There is no other towns. There's no stores. There's nothing.
But you knew the town drunk.
Yeah. Everybody.
Yeah.
You knew everybody and everybody's business and everybody. It was that's the town. That's what it was. You know, it was very much like that. Very Mayberry in that way. Because it was also had a little bit of a frozen in time nature to it. Like it was not, there were no stores.
Were there other Greeks?
No, there were no other Greeks. It was all WASPy New England. You know, like I was, like we were like a minority family.
Right.
As Greeks who are European, ancestry.
Your last name.
Oh yeah. Where are you from? That's my favorite. Where are you from?
Suspect.
Jason, where are you from?
Suspect.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, but the what about the comedy?
Swampscott High School? So junior and senior year, the classes would put on a variety show.
Yeah.
And so me and my friend like wrote all the comedy sketches for those years of variety shows.
Uh-huh.
And so that was for me, like, and I was like obsessed with comedy.
Yeah.
Like I was like, I was a kid who was obsessed with like sketch comedy. I listened to, like, you know, I would mow the lawn to like the first Stephen Wright tape when it came out.
Sure.
All those guys I was aware of, but I watched SNL every week. I was like that when Monty Python started airing on PBS, it was like huge to me.
Yeah.
You know, stuff like that was.
So it was planted.
Yeah. Oh, that's what I was really. So that when I got to college, I immediately.
I heard it.
What?
Got.
Yeah. When I got to college, Mark, let me tell you something, Mark. When I got to college, these fucking guys.
When I got to college
in Vermont.
Yeah.
What are you still going to that school in Vermont? I was walking down the street in New York City as like in my 30s.
Yeah.
And a New York City cop goes, "Hey, Mantzoukas." And I was like, "Oh fuck, what have I done?" And I was like, "Oh, maybe this cop is like a fan or something. I don't know." But I wasn't really doing much at the time. And it happened to be a kid I grew up with who was a Boston cop and was on some sort of exchange.
Yeah.
First thing he says is, "Hey, are you still fucking allergic to eggs?" And I was like, "Wow, A, amazing pull, and B, it sounds so good in that accent."
Did you grow up with that guy?
Yeah. He was from my hometown. He was in my Boy Scout troop. That's why he remembered the eggs. He was like, "I remember we always used to give you our cold cereal because that's all you could eat."
That's a nice story.
Yeah.
We used to kick your ass because you couldn't eat eggs.
No.
It was the other way.
It really was like people would look out for me in a weird way because there was like baked in vulnerability to me as a child and everybody knew it.
Oh, really?
Because I was like, when I grew up, nobody else had fatal food allergies. It wasn't as predominant as it is now. So like everybody in my school was aware of it. Everybody in town was aware of it. All the Boy Scouts were aware of it. So it was as if everybody who were all these kind of tough Boston towny archetypes were with a boy made of glass.
Right.
Who they'd be like, "We got to carry the boy made of glass around.
No eggs for this
kid."
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
And then as a result, I become very funny, I think, and they're like, "Hey, you're funny."
Yeah, yeah. Well, no, it is a hardened character there, but you know, it's weird because when I go back up there and I spent seven years there.
Sure.
It's very intimidating, but they are a pretty caring bunch. They're very, you know, engaged.
There's tremendous heart in there.
Yeah.
But it is such a gruff demeanor.
Tough,
That is trying to hide that heart.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
That they are, you know, it is.
I think it's the Irish.
It's 100% the Irish.
Yeah.
That temper, that flair, that boom, you know, like.
But also that sort of like, "Yeah, we're all fucked."
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, and I fucking love you.
Yeah, you know,
all of it.
Yeah.
I do love it. I love that city.
I've grown to appreciate it.
It's pretty great.
It's weird when you go back, when you're in something, there's a menace to it, at least for a period of time. But then when you go back, as you get older, you're like, this is great.
Yeah.
The nostalgia takes over and you forget.
I get really, and it makes me really, like somebody was telling me a story recently about like, oh man, I did a show in Boston. We were out to dinner and like these guys at the next table were like, made a big deal about like what big fans they were, and then they wanted a picture, and we were like, oh yeah, can we just do it? We're in the middle of eating. Yeah. Can we do it when we're done eating?
Right.
And it was like, it was maybe within 10 seconds I thought I was about to be in like my first fight since high school. Like the guy was like, oh, you're fucking too good to take a picture with me? I just fucking told you I'm a fucking fan. We were at your fucking show.
Right.
And it's like, boom. And you start to pay. It's like the distance between a friendly compliment and about to get your ass kicked.
Oh, that's who you
seconds.
Are. That's who you are.
You're fucking too good for me.
Yeah,
huh?
You're right.
Mr. Fancy Guy.
No, I don't need a picture.
No, you know what? Fuck it.
Fuck you.
Fuck it.
Fuck you.
I'll be waiting fucking outside for you. You little shit.
So were you in a band though in high school?
I was in a bunch of bands. I was also in marching band. I was in like the school and jazz band, all the school bands. And then
you could read music, right?
I could, yep.
Still can, I imagine.
Still can, yep. And then I was in like rock bands. I was in like bands that would be like, we would do cover, I was in cover bands that would do like
Jane's Addiction. Did you go into Boston and play places?
We didn't ever. We went and played like all the kind of
stuff on the island?
All the suburbs of.
Right.
Marblehead, Beverly, Salem, all the kind of Battle of the Bands and kids bands and high school, all the punk and hard, because it was also like punk hardcore era where there would be.
Were you in one of those
six
bands?
Six bands. I was in a band that would play like Faith No More style, like Primus kind of proggy. We were better musicians.
Right.
But like super like aggressive stuff.
Yeah.
I was in a bunch of bands.
Yeah. So you go to college, you've written some comedy, some sketch comedy, school variety show,
sure.
You've played Primus,
yeah.
You're ready to go to college,
yeah.
You've got two great skills,
yeah.
Now, what do you do when you get there? Do you get in a band?
I get into a band, and I start like a jazz group that I also play with, like just a straight ahead like kind of, you know, bebop group essentially, And then I also join what is like at the time, like the college has just started, or the people at the college, a group of young, like a group of kids have started an improv group.
Yeah.
And so I join that because
Right away.
I try out right away. I don't get in until like the next semester.
Right.
And then become completely obsessed with that.
You've never done it before.
Never done it.
But you got a jazz brain and you got funny guy.
It's all improv.
Right.
So for me, it's the same skill set, just applied in different directions.
Right, but this is a college improv group. Yeah. So what are you doing? You're doing games?
We're doing short form games.
Yeah.
And it's all the corny, it's all Whose Line Is It Anyway?
Yeah.
You know, corny games. But it's the first time that I'm ever like, you know, we would do like the variety show in high school or band, you know, concerts or whatever, like to a couple hundred people. But like for some reason, because it was like, I went to school in Vermont, like small liberal arts college.
Which
Vermont,
one?
Middlebury.
Yeah.
But like we would, this improv group would do shows to like 600-700 people for some reason.
Oh, really?
Like,
they'd all popular. Come out?
Like, everybody would come and
was
watch.
There nowhere to go in town?
Truly, there was not. It was a desolate place. And so that was the first time I had like, oh, wow.
Yeah.
This is fucking huge. This room is enormous. All these people are laughing. They're going nuts. It was super fun. And then a guy named Rod. Do you know Rodney Rothman at all?
No.
He's a writer here in town. Very successful. Has worked on a ton of stuff. He was in the same improv group that I was in. And he went and interned in New York at like Chicago City Limits. Do you remember what that is?
Sure, yeah, I do. I
and he came
in
back
there.
With Truth in Comedy, the long form improv textbook, basically.
Right.
And he was like, "This exists.
Was
I've seen this."
Was that the Del Close book?
Yeah. He said, "This is the thing. This is it. We got to be doing this."
He brought that back to college.
Yeah. And so we all read the book. None of us had seen what like a Harold was or what long form improv
and
was.
And you're what, a sophomore?
Yeah, at this point I'm a sophomore, or I'm maybe a first semester of junior year, but I think I'm a sophomore.
So this is one of those moments, it's like the drum teacher.
A true epiphany.
Yeah.
Although misguided, because we read the book and attempt to do it on a small scale. We want to do it in like the coffee shop on campus. but it's, we are terrible at it. Yeah. And it's,
it, well, what was the challenge at that time? Cause I don't fully understand it.
Like, okay. So, I mean, it's like the difference between like big band and like bebop.
Right.
Like,
right.
Big band, you're playing the chart. You know, you really are adhering to structure.
Yeah.
That's like the games. Yeah. Short form games are limited in scope. They are short in format and they are a prescribed game. So the idea of short form games is like, conceptually speaking, improv, if everything is possible,
yeah,
you are more inclined to panic.
Right.
And so everything you put on it is to restrict the possibilities.
Right.
So short form games are incredibly restrictive. So, right. So much so that you really are only improvising a very small element of the whole scene.
Well, it's like shtick.
It's, yeah. You're just plugging in joke, basically.
So short form is like from, would that be an audience suggestion game?
Correct.
Right.
Okay, we need a non-geographic location and a profession. And then now you know you're doing jokes about those two things and blah, blah, blah. It doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Long form is like, you're going to get one suggestion. The word is burrito.
Yeah.
And you're going to do like a 30 to 40 minute or longer, depending, show of different scenes, connected scenes, group scenes, all of it that is born of that one suggestion.
Yeah, I've seen some of it at
like
UCB.
Like ASCAD or stuff like that. Right. And so as a result, you're seeing like something that is a lot more built from the ground up than it is like within the confines of a game or something.
Yeah.
So, but when we read the book, we were just like, okay, so I guess, so the first part of it traditionally is of the Herald is like a pattern game. So if you say burrito is the suggestion, great. So for the first minute and a half, we do some, the group as a whole does some sort of like idea where they kind of take the word burrito or take whatever that inspires and they examine it for a minute or so just to kind of generate a bunch of information.
Yeah.
People might tell a story, people might whatever, it doesn't matter. A minute and a half, right? Just to put some stuff on the table. We used to do that for 15 minutes.
Yeah.
And it would just be like burrito, beans, rice, tortilla, lunch, sandwich.
Yeah.
Like, and that, this is what happened for 15 minutes. And
we were
so serious. No laughs. Of course no laughs, Mark. We were doing nonsense. It was terrible. And we did this for a long time. And then eventually I went to New York and UCB was just starting and I watched it and I was like, oh, this is what it was supposed to be doing. It's supposed to be like joyful and fun and not austere and like breakfast, breakfast cereals. Cocoa Puffs, Captain Crunch.
You do like a game show answers with no rules.
Really? Yeah, that's what it was. It was terrible. But that started like that process of like improv, comedy, and like that's at that point. And then I also ran the radio station at college, and those were the two things I cared the most about.
You ran the radio station?
Yeah.
Like you were the manager?
I eventually was the programming manager.
Yeah,
eventually. I started out as like the jazz manager. Then became, you know.
Because nobody wanted to do
it. Literally, I went to the first meeting.
Yeah.
And nobody wanted to be they assigned every other position. And they were like, the only thing we don't have is, it's jazz. And I was like, yes?
Yeah.
And I was like, just got to college. And they're like, okay, you. And I was like, that's it? That's all it takes? And I knew some stuff about jazz.
Did you have your records?
I had some of my records. This was the best.
Yeah.
The best thing that happens at the end of my freshman year, the GM came to me and said, hey, we have not used our budget for the year. And if we get to the end of the year without spending it, we have to give it back. So here's $3,000 to buy records with over the summer. And so I was like, what? He was like, just bring them back with you when you come back to school.
Yeah, yeah.
He's like, I just need to give this money out so that we don't.
Yeah.
So I took that $3,000. And like the first week I was home, I went to Tower Records one of the biggest record stores.
Yeah.
And I bought $3,000 worth of
jazz
and spent the whole summer just crushing it, just consuming, and then brought it all up. And it was the best summer
because
I bought everything.
You built their library.
I built their library.
Yeah.
It really was. Yeah. I built their CD library.
Did you mix it up? Did you do
a big band? Yep, totally. Wait,
you were
a
curator.
I went from Dixieland and Ragtime, like Fats Waller and all that stuff, all the way through like Fusion, Mahavishnu Orchestra, all the...
So you knew you had a job. You were a curator.
Oh, absolutely.
And I
was very responsible. I was very nerdy about it and would try and like turn people onto stuff and they'd be like, I don't like this.
Yeah.
I don't like... That was the other thing is I would always like play stuff for people. Like we were looking at your records beforehand and there was a Husker Du record in there. And I remember I got turned onto Husker Du like maybe eighth grade.
Yeah, yeah.
And I remember like bringing it to like a buddy's like house and being like, dude, this is amazing. You got to listen to this. And like literally like that guy then not really being my friend anymore. It's being like,
yeah,
you're into weird
you.
Stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
You're into like weird music.
And then with jazz, you're sort of like, just hang out. It's only a 15 minute tune. And it gets real good.
Yeah. The solo is amazing. And that's the part that people have the most trouble with.
Right.
I don't understand what's happening now.
But they must have been very grateful that you built out their jazz library. So were you on the air late at night or what were you just...
Sundays. Oh. Our station was all
four
day
hours?
Sunday. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And then as I got further into it, I would just be on air all the time.
Oh, really?
You know, because anytime we had holes in the schedule, I would just go and... I would just pick a thing that I wanted to become obsessed with or that I was... slightly obsessed with, and I would just do a deep dive into that thing.
Like, so like one artist or
like
hard bop
Africa.
Or something?
Oh, like yeah. At one point, Africa. I became obsessed with like sub-Saharan African music.
Like Senegalese music?
Mali, all of it. You know, Fela, all that stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
Like Afropop, all of it.
Yeah.
And would just be like, great, this is what I'm going to do. And I'm just going to get into this. And there's, at the time, no internet.
Yeah.
There's no research. I just have the library that's available to us and what I can kind of read.
Now, did you have any fans of the show?
When I had my jazz show, this was the best. When I had my jazz show, and when I tell you I was like on the radio, like it was a 100 watt radio station that then became a 1000 watt radio station. So it reached basically the town of.
Yeah.
And the dorms.
Right.
It was not like I was out on the air.
But you were in it, though.
I used to get collect calls from the prison for the jazz show. Every week, a guy would call collect from prison and ask for Miles Davis.
Yeah. And you
and
play
I
play
it.
That's your one
play
guy.
It. Yeah.
The one guy.
And I was like, dude, I love this. Absolutely. And I was like, even if it's a prank.
Right.
I still love it because I'm going to play. You're playing Miles. You want me to play Miles? Yeah. If it's a prank, sure.
You knew it wasn't a prank, though.
I don't think it was. It seemed pretty real.
So now you're running the radio station. You're doing improv. You figured it out. When you went to New York, though, was that the thing that made you realize, like, oh, shit, there's a world out here for this?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I'm at that point, like, pretty aware of Second City.
Yeah.
I'm aware of Groundlings. Like, I know things exist. I know that there are hubs.
Right.
For this.
Right.
But I also very much want to move to New York City.
Right. You didn't think about Chicago? You didn't get obsessed with Del Close and the whole legacy of that?
I did. Like, I met Del Close. I did at the... there used to be Skidmore used to do an improv festival every year for all the college groups.
Yeah.
And they brought Del one year. Like,
he was old,
maybe
though,
like
right?
4 years before he died. Three, 4 years before he died. I mean, probably longer, actually. But not too much longer. Anyway... And he came and was like predictably Del Close, like a relentless prick to everybody for the whole of it. And it was awesome.
Yeah.
You know, it was really cool.
So he ran a seminar type of thing?
Yeah. He kind of gave notes to people as they did stuff. But so I was like very into it, but I came to New York.
Did you graduate?
Graduated. Yep.
What was your degree in?
Religion.
Really?
Yeah. In as much as... I needed something to major in.
So you put it together at the
end?
And
I liked that department. I tried being a philosophy major, but I am not a good enough student. And even a religion major. Like when I wrote an honors thesis, went to my thesis defense, and my professor goes, Jason, his first line, Jason, you're not a great scholar. But thank God your gifts and graces lie elsewhere. So let's take this and put it aside. I can't give you honors for this. This was not very good. Did you even proofread this? And I was like, Larry, I did not.
What was it on?
It was on religious iconography. It was, when I tell you, I wrote it in like maybe 8 days.
Yeah.
And it was 100 some odd pages. It was terrible. He had every right to be like, I'm not giving you honors for this.
But it was interesting that you picked like a fairly non-challenging, non-philosophical area.
Totally.
Like, let's look at this. Yep.
And
pictures.
If you asked me now about it, I could tell you zero. I could tell you not one single thing
about it. But there must have been just a dearth of information of, you know, totems and talismans and you know, relics and whatever.
Absolutely. Yeah, bleeding icons, crying icons, all of it. Yeah. But it was enough that it interested me and was within. But here's the thing. I didn't need to do it.
Yeah.
It was like the arrogance on my part to be like, yeah, I'll fucking write a thesis. Why not?
Yeah. No, I've been that guy.
Yeah.
I auditioned at Yale Drama, you know, and I submitted a photo strip as my headshot.
Okay. I love that. I love that.
I got this ace.
That's great. These guys, they get it.
They don't. You can't, you know, charm will only take you so far.
Oh, absolutely. But but in a great way, like that same thesis, like that that professor who loved me and who I loved and who was like, you're just not, this isn't what you should be doing.
Yeah.
He also was like, he did this, he goes, at one point he was teaching a 3-hour New Testament class.
Yeah.
And in the middle of the whole thing, he goes, will you walk back to my office with me? I was like, yeah, sure. And he goes, so I feel like about midway through the class, I'm losing them.
Yeah.
How do you think I could kind of engage them and get them back on track? He's asking me like performance questions.
Right, right. Yeah, yeah.
And I was like, let's get into it. And I was like, this is what I can do. This I can give you. Like the rest of it, I'm a mess.
Yeah.
But like on a actual intellectual level, no. But this I can definitely help.
What'd
you
do?
And I was like, at a certain point, you can't just talk at us, you know, like at a certain point, I think you got to open it up and you have to engage in a way that isn't, do we know the material? That is more just a conversational break.
Yeah.
You know, because we can't, it's not just a matter of like, let's take a break and come back.
Yeah.
Like you need to have us engage in the break right. with you. Like, so that like the whole thing becomes broken down into something like, that is
right. So in the middle, he just out of nowhere goes, is there a God? What is this God
and like,
business?
You see people be like, what's going on? What do we do? Yeah. What do we do now?
They put their pencils down. One kid wakes up.
Yeah, exactly.
What happened?
3 hours.
Yeah. So, all right. So that you get your religion degree.
Mm-hmm.
And then what do?
I get, I have a very weird post-college, I get a grant out of college and I live abroad for 2 years doing an ethnomusicology project.
How'd that come together?
Middlebury is one of the it's called a Watson Fellowship.
Mm-hmm.
This thing I got, and it's like a non-academic Fulbright.
But
kind of, you
sought it out. They didn't just.
I did.
So you weren't real clear on what the hell you wanted to do. This was
the thing that attracted to me. There was like, there's a grant that's out there that our college is one of the nominating colleges for. And you have to propose an idea that you think would be cool to do that is not part of your, that you would not pursue academically otherwise.
Right.
The point of it is they want to finance and fund your kind of experimental year.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so I did that. I pitched them a project that was, and it was typically like, I'm a terrible student. So my proposal was shitty, but I was charming in the room.
Right.
And so I got it.
But this is for the last 2 years of college or 2 years after?
2 years after.
So you really weren't chomping at the bit to get down to New York to do long form improv?
I wasn't yet because this, I was like very curious about this. I was like, somebody will give me money to go abroad.
What was the pitch?
The pitch was, it was music that was meant to induce a state of prayer, like holy prayer and union with something holy.
So you're drawing on your religion degree.
And my music.
Right.
My music interest.
Right.
And it was like a lot of it was like there's a jazz pianist named Randy Weston.
Yeah.
Great jazz pianist. And he becomes obsessed with this music from Morocco called Ganawa music that is this like incredibly hypnotic, beautiful, rhythmic, trance-inducing music that is meant to exorcise demons.
It's very difficult to wrap your brain around.
Yeah. So I find this Randy Weston album in my kind of, at the radio station
that you had
research.
Bought. Yeah.
And I was like, this is fucking crazy.
Yeah.
He's amazing, but what these Moroccan musicians doing is like wild.
Yeah.
And so I was basically like, I want to go to Morocco and talk to these people.
Yeah.
And I kind of built a project around that as the centerpiece.
Yeah.
And then wound up going to other places as well. But it was all about like music that was supposed to kind of bring you into union with God.
Yeah. The trance.
Whatever
music.
Your God
the,
is.
The transcendental music.
Yeah. Whirling dervishes in Turkey. Yeah. All of it. Yeah. Sufi Islam. All of it. Yeah. So,
you went to all those places?
Yeah.
Where'd you go?
Morocco, Egypt, Israel, and Turkey. And then I traveled in like Jordan and Syria.
Huh.
Yeah.
So that must have been mind-blowing.
It was like beyond. Like it truly is like I genuinely believe the only reason I do everything I do is because of those 2 years. Like those 2 years of I got on a plane. Their whole thing is we'll give you the money. The only rule is you can't come back to the United States for at least a year.
Yeah.
And I landed in Morocco.
And with what? What, just like a, like Fyodor's book or yep, Lonely
with
Planet?
Like a, yes, a Lonely Planet book and a rough guide.
Yeah, and the names of the music you wanted to go find.
Yeah.
So you had to go to these places.
And when I tell you that I'd prepared, not at all.
Yeah.
Didn't know where I was going to go.
Yeah.
Barely knew who to be even looking for. Didn't know even if they were there. I got there and a lot of people were like, oh, those guys are in Paris.
Oh, really?
And I was like, what?
The only guys who have to do it?
But not the only guys, but I then found other guys, which was awesome.
Yeah.
But I really went thinking like, yeah, and I bet people are going to speak English. And I got there, and when I tell you I had like a straight up nervous breakdown, I had a nervous breakdown within
the first
3 weeks in Morocco.
Yeah.
I lost my mind.
And what'd you do?
I panicked. I was genuinely like, I don't know what to do. I don't know who to talk. I was spending days.
It wasn't an existential nervous breakdown.
No, it was like
what did I get myself into nervous breakdown?
Correct.
Yeah.
And I was like, and the prison of, I can't go home for a year.
Yeah.
And I don't know anybody. And days were going by and I wasn't speaking to any living person.
But you're eating good food,
terrified.
Right?
Terrified. No, because I'm terrified of food. Food is like, I have such a complicated relationship with food.
Is there eggs in this in Moroccan?
Of course. It was terrifying. And so finally I meet some people and everything mellows out. And I basically learn to be like a self-sustaining adult.
Yeah.
You know, in those 2 years. And that's transformative in who I am and my willingness to take chances and put myself into situations that I'm would otherwise be scared by or uncomfortable by.
Yeah, nothing's going to happen on stage that's going to match Morocco.
I was arrested in Morocco. I was put in jail in Turkey. Like, I've been like in really sketchy, scary places. So I'm like, you want me to get up and do like an hour of improv and not know what's going on? Yeah, I'll fucking do that. What are you talking about? It's like the easy. People are like, I'm so scared and not know what to say. And I'm like, that's like the easiest thing.
Well, what'd you get arrested for in Morocco?
Stupid stuff. Oh. Stupid stuff. Like, literally, I got arrested in Morocco. It's like, it's not sexy stuff, but it's like, it was terrifying in its,
because you don't
what
know,
happened.
Right. Well, you don't know. All of a sudden, it's like, you're in jail.
I got arrested in Morocco for having an expired tourist visa, which they told me was fine. I called the embassy and I said, I'm going to leave the country. My thing expired. They were like, don't worry, you're leaving the country. They're not going to care. I'm in Tangiers. I go to the port. I'm going to get on a boat and go to Spain. Arrested. They put me in a holding cell. And I'm like, oh, okay, I guess at the port. And I'm going to say, I'm going to sign something.
But aren't you thinking like Midnight Express is about to happen?
Yes. When they load me in a paddy wagon with a bunch of other guys that are straight up criminals.
Yeah.
I'm like, oh, this is not good. And I am in prison for like 18 hours in a general holding cell, and I've got like $2,000 worth of audio equipment on me. I'm the only foreigner in there, and everybody's like, hey my friend, and I'm just like head down, like not talking to anybody. And then I had to wait until
you couldn't tell them why you were in there.
No. And I had to wait until they convened like three judges to see everybody's case who was in that room.
Yeah.
So it just took forever.
Right.
And it was, and I didn't know. I kept thinking like, well, of course, once they look at my passport and see him, like I would be so cool and like, I'm cool, don't worry about it. The minute I would get into trouble, I would become like the most relentless, ugly American.
Oh, really?
I'd be like waving my passport, being like, I'm American. It was awful. Same thing in Turkey. Like we got stopped. We were trying to-
Turkey, that's actually where Midnight Express took place,
100%.
Right? Yeah.
But we were dumb. Like, I was dumb, and I was young, and so, like, we rented a car.
Who's we?
I was with a guy that I'd met in Marrakesh, like a buddy of mine, who was in the Peace Corps in Morocco. When he finished Peace Corps Morocco.
Oh, he went with you?
He came and found me in Turkey for 2 weeks. He was like, I'll just come there before I go home, and we can travel around. Great. We go to southeastern Turkey. We start driving straight towards, like, the PKK, the part of Turkey that's in a civil war, basically.
Right.
And we're like, because we used to do that thing where we'd be like, where's the sketchiest place in this country?
Yeah.
Let's try and go there.
Yeah.
Like, we tried to get into Iran. I tried to get into Lebanon. Like, closed countries.
They'd Why?
Be like, just because we were stupid, you know?
Well, and you were curious, I guess, and you wanted to have the story.
Of course. Always wanted the story.
Yeah.
But the military pulled us out of our car and, like, put us in jail for a night. And we were like, we're Americans, you can't do this. We were like fucking assholes.
Yeah.
Assholes. And then there's artillery fire all night long. Huge cannon artillery fire.
Right.
And we are like terrified.
Yeah.
Terrified. And then in the morning they come, pick us up, and they bring us back to our car. And and only then were we like, they were protecting us.
Right.
They were protecting us from driving into an active war zone at night.
You idiot.
So they held us for the night and let us drive home.
Right.
But like, and we treated them like fucking assholes.
And they're probably another one, another two Americans. Yeah, here we go.
Two more shitheads. But yeah, no, we were stupid.
Well, what'd you learn from the music though?
The music was, a lot of it was really, Morocco, I spent the most time in Morocco, 7.5 months in Morocco. Yeah. And it was really interesting because the music was still, once I kind of drilled down into and found the guys that were still doing it and earned their trust and was able to go, because basically this music is played at like ceremonies that are meant to be like, if somebody's sick, like whether it's like a cancer or whatever, there is part of what happens is they will bring in these musicians to, and all the songs are associated with different colors and all the colors are associated with different demons.
Uh-huh.
And so the presumption is that this person who's sick is possessed by some sort of demon.
Right.
And we're going to just play music from sundown till sun up until we figure it out. And we're going to play and dance the demon out of them.
Wow.
And so that is the stuff that eventually I would, again, very dumb and trusting. They'd be like, be here at like 5 o'clock. We're going to pick you up. We're going to drive out to a place and this, you're going to see it. And I would get into a car with a bunch of random dudes, drive like an hour outside Marrakesh and go to someone's house. And this would happen. And people would be like stabbing themselves with knives and people would be dancing. And it was like dancing in a trance, not dancing like I'm enjoying the music.
Right.
But like it was incredibly powerful to watch.
It was shamanistic.
Correct.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
And,
really.
And you're recording it or you're writing? Or
I would not record those because it was not cool to record those things. But some of those musicians, I would then record just like in their house.
Yeah.
Just without the...
What are they playing? What are the instruments?
The instruments are just... one guy is playing what's called a gimbri, which is like a three-stringed gut-stringed instrument.
Yeah.
And then like metal castanets, big giant metal castanets is essentially what they are, that are providing just a driving constant rhythm that is unrelenting and exhausting.
And they do it all night.
All night.
And did it work?
You would see people like have like truly kind of what seemed to me to be like out of body experiences.
Huh.
Like you would, because the other thing is they would be playing music for the person who was sick, but they'd be playing all these songs. So then sometimes you'd see people who were just sitting around on the edges, just like having a coffee or a tea or something. And then all of a sudden they'd be like, they'd fall to the floor. they would start playing a song and somebody would just fall to the floor and then just start kind of having like almost a seizure, almost a spasm.
And you thought it was genuine.
It seemed genuine.
Why
would you just fall to the ground if you're just observing?
There's no preacher putting on a shtick.
Nope. Nobody's asking for you to do anything. People would just like...
Was this part of a religious practice?
It is. It is something that has existed prior to Islam in North Africa, but has been Islamicized since Islam came to North Africa.
Right.
So it is...
Well, you musicians, they know when they need to keep a gig.
Yeah. Anyway, so I did that for a couple of years and then came back and moved to New York and right as UCB was starting, basically.
But like all these different varieties of this spiritual music, were you on any personal spiritual quest?
Did it
affect anything about your understanding of people in the world in the sense of anything that you carried with you? Or
that's a great question. It did, in as much as it bolstered and solidified my belief that everybody is searching for some union with something.
Yeah.
And even though all these different people are interpreting it differently and are it's not unlike all the religion, because the religion department at Middlebury was just a comparative religion department.
Yeah.
We studied everything.
Right.
And you just are like, oh, all these tenets are the same. They're just,
different
practice.
Guys. Different.
It's just practice is the only difference.
Right.
And so it was really interesting to be like, oh, it's interesting to watch people process music in that same way. And like, oh, one of the methodologies to get to enlightenment is music.
Right.
You know, just like there's also like Zen monks whose practice is archery.
Right.
You know, that I'm like, when I found that out, I was like, what do you mean archery?
Yeah.
And it's like, that is their meditation.
Sure.
And meditation is archery.
And they've incorporated into the religious spiritual system.
And it's really interesting.
Yeah.
That idea of constantly being, I also lived in Greek monasteries for a while, and it was like that idea of constantly being in prayer.
Yeah.
Was very interesting to me.
I'm impressed with it, but it's you've got to, the things you have to shut off.
Yeah.
you know, in order to live that life, which is virtuous or very specific.
It's an aesthetic
anyway.
Life, yeah.
But it's like, it's a tall order.
Oh, very hard.
I don't.
But pieces of it, very compelling.
No, definitely. You know? But it's like the discipline of it, you know, better be enough to make you feel good about yourself.
Yeah. Yeah. Or better make you not feel anything about yourself.
Lose the ego.
Lose that. You know?
And connect in, you're in direct relationship with God.
I think so. Yeah. But I mean, like, as two people who are only seeking individual glory constantly.
Well,
on
that's
stage.
An American thing in a way. Yeah. There is something about self-centeredness and careerism,
sure.
Entitlement.
Yeah, getting
you know, what
ahead.
About me?
Oh yeah.
You know, I'm doing unique things.
Yeah.
You know, that whole thing. It does.
Why pursue the universal when I can pursue the individual?
Well, that shit wears out, dude.
Mm-hmm.
And then all of a sudden you're like, you're at the end of it or in middle age and you're like, I got no universal.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
So now what do I do?
Oh yeah. How do I, yeah, I agree.
How do I not be a dick?
Yeah.
How do I justify
my existence as part of society, part of humanity?
Yeah, because you can fool yourself for a long time.
Yeah.
Like, I'm contributing. Are you really, though? Yeah, that was funny.
And for how long and to who?
Yeah, exactly.
You know?
Yeah, exactly.
But it really is like, you know, and
There's the other point. It's like, if you can play Miles Davis for that one guy who's locked up, isn't that something?
Wasn't that great?
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
So now when you come back to New York, that's when UCB is just starting. So it's like 94.
No, it's a little later. It's 97, 98.
The new UCB.
Yeah. No, it's still they don't have a theater yet because it's still solo arts. And they get the
first one with
22nd Street.
Yeah.
Right as in like 98. Basically.
Yeah.
So like within the first year,
late,
I'm
huh?
there.
Right.
You know, and it's up and running for a couple of years before it's shut down.
So you come back, you're like, you're a world traveler.
Sure.
You've had mystical experiences.
Totally.
You've been in jail in Turkey and Morocco.
Yes.
And you're like, now you've decided you got what music
comedy.
And spirituality out of your system.
A little bit.
You figured it out, some of it.
Yeah.
And you're ready to go to the next thing.
Yeah, I really am. Because at this point, I'm also like, I don't know if I'm going to be a musician. I don't know if this is, if I can do it, and I don't know, but I'm super compelled by comedy. You know, like I'm like really, and at this point I visit New York. When I come back, before I move, I come, because my friend Rodney, who I mentioned earlier, is in New York, and he brings me to see a UCB show at the Red Room at KGB.
Right, okay, upstairs.
Upstairs at KGB.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was like, this is the thing.
Well, yeah, because like that makes sense to me, because the one thing you have to accept in terms of being a musician, especially with the stuff you were interested in, is like it's not for everybody.
No.
And there's something about comedy or about sketch comedy that not only with a band you have community, but you have this, you know, this active creative spirit, but it's for everybody.
Yeah. Yeah. It scratched the same itch, but was social and ensemble based in a way that, because I was like, I don't think I'm going to be a stand-up comedian. I don't think that's for me. I don't think I would be good at it.
Yeah.
But improv and sketch, I think is my thing.
Yeah.
You know, and then I started doing UCB and was immediately like all in on that. Like the concept of being a musician like evaporated
almost
instantly. So
the original four were still around and involved.
Oh yeah, they were all my teachers.
Yeah.
They were my teachers.
Matt,
Amy, and Ian. And then Armando Diaz, did you know him at all?
No, I'm sure I met him.
Yeah.
See, the thing is this weird is that like I was around then and like I just ignored the whole goddamn thing.
Of course.
Why? What do you mean of course?
Well, I mean, like at the time, it was not a venue that would have been someplace you would go.
But I was an asshole about it. I was like, I'm a stand-up. You know, this is what we do here.
I know.
And then, New
York at that time was a stand-up town.
Yeah, but then like the alt scene started to happen.
Sure.
And then when I was at Luna Lounge, the four started.
Rebar, right?
Well, Rebar, the original one. Yeah. But that wasn't for that long before it moved to Luna Lounge. But then the four started doing their bits.
Sure.
And then other people, the state guys started coming around.
Yep.
And then you guys were all doing this amazing stuff, and we were like, "No, we're playing bars."
Totally,
you know.
Oh, and that's the thing, though, that existed
in New York. I never felt
that
you guys were like those stand-ups got it going on. I don't know what the spirit of it was. I don't know how we cohabitated.
What was really interesting is that, like, we existed truly. I felt like in those first years, like unto ourselves. I was not plugged into the world at all. Even like the scene, the comedy scene. I knew obviously what the Stella guys were doing or stuff like that. But I didn't go around and see other people's stuff.
You were all in.
I was just UCB.
It was like a cult.
It really was. And people would call it a cult all the time.
They would?
Oh, yeah. People would be like, oh, that place is a cult. And I know what they meant.
A cult of comedy.
There was a definite like... It was our place, and we were building it from the like. It was really exciting to be part of a scene from the ground up.
So, who was in like when you after you learned from that generation, who are my age?
Yeah.
What was your crew?
Crew was like the generation that I come up in is that kind of first generation that is like, Paul Scheer, Rob Hubel,
right.
Owen Burke. Danielle Schneider and Donna Fineglass. Kroll's younger than all of us.
Yeah.
So Cordry, Seth Morris, Brian Husky.
I love Seth Morris.
John Bowie. I love Seth Morris.
He's so funny.
And then like John Daly and Gelman. Gelman, they're a little younger than us, but started basically at the same time, but they were like kids.
Yeah.
I'm trying, like all that early, you know, like Helms, blah, blah, blah. And then Kroll is like a little bit younger than us in age, and he kind of arrives a couple years later.
He arrives a fully formed comedic wizard.
Yeah. Well, him, and then a couple years later, Mulaney follows him because they were both Georgetown guys together.
Oh, okay.
And then they
hook up with Aziz for the Human Giant?
Human Giant is actually many years later because Aziz is quite a bit younger.
Yeah.
And so that whole scene is like... For the first bunch of years is just really us doing shows for each other in an old hand job centric strip club on 22nd Street.
Where the Hasids used to come wondering.
And Fleet Week.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, really? They all show up?
Oh, yeah. Because
they heard about
Fleet
the
Week.
Took a couple of years before people realized it wasn't there anymore.
And they would always be wasted. And they'd be like, we want to see the show. And we'd be like at the front because, you know, like in order to take classes... I would work at the ticket booth or whatever. I would intern there or whatever. And they would be like, we want to see the show. And we'd be like, this is a comedy theater. And they would just go straight in and then come straight out and be like, what the fuck's going on, man?
same with the
Hasidic Jews. They would all go, like shamefully kind of go in and we'd be like, this is not the Harmony Theater anymore. Just so you know. But they were so uncomfortable with it. They would just kind of go in.
Right.
And then sometimes watch the show because they were now uncomfortable to leave. And then sometimes just immediately leave.
So occasionally you'd have a chassid or two?
Oh, yeah. Oh, that happened for the first two or three years, like semi-regularly, just because it was such a well-known, apparently, $5 hand job.
$5?
$5 hand jobs in the bathrooms was the Harmony
Theater. I hate when Jews live up to their stereotype.
Right? Yeah. But it was a great, like, it was a very exciting time. It was also like, nobody was looking at us.
Yeah.
Nobody had agents. Nobody had managers. Nobody had deals. Nobody had anything.
Nobody was
on SNL.
Earnest.
Nobody had a TV show. Yeah. Nobody had nothing. We were doing bad shows for each other, just getting better.
So you weren't pulling tickets yet? There's not people coming? It hadn't... Were you there when it turned?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. When people started getting agents and when people started getting deals and when people started getting stuff, there was certain people who like Aspen at the time was a real launching pad for people.
Yeah.
So people would get a sketch show together, go to Aspen and get something out of it.
You're right.
Agents. And then eventually people started moving to LA and getting work.
Right.
Like Andy Daly got Mad TV.
Yeah.
And Donna Fineglass got Mad TV. That was huge.
Right.
Because they were contemporaries. It wasn't like the UCB for having a Comedy Central show.
Right.
Which was like, yeah, of course. They're like our, they're like the people.
Elders.
They're like the elders, yeah. But like when people that we came up with started doing stuff, it was wild and exciting. You know, it was crazy.
Yeah.
And then the internet happened and then it was almost like I felt like what happened when Nirvana broke and every Pacific Northwest band got signed.
Right.
Like when the internet happened and suddenly everybody could put sketches online and suddenly everybody was represented.
Yeah.
Everybody
had
deals.
Right.
Everything was happening.
Right.
And this, like, it was like a bright light was all of a sudden on our whole scene, which was cool.
Yeah.
And then the LA theater opening was really, I think, the transformative element.
On Franklin.
That first theater on Franklin in 2005.
Yeah,
that
sure.
was a huge moment.
Right, because I was out here in 2002. I lived around the corner from it. And it wasn't the UCB Theater yet. It was just a place.
It was the Tamron Theater.
Yeah, but they did stuff though still.
Oh yeah.
Like you could do comedy there, right?
Yep, I think so. It was like a rentable space.
Right.
Yeah.
So when do you start getting work in the big show business?
It takes a long time for me to work.
But now you're like in everything.
Yeah, a little bit. I'm in everything for me. That's right.
You're like, there's that guy.
Hey, look at him.
Yeah, and then
there's that guy. I liked him on that other thing. He was funny on this one too.
He always looks the same. He's very consistent.
Yep, absolutely. I'm lucky that way, I guess. It takes me a long, long time, mostly because I have a very funny. I get a lot of success early on as part of like me and Jessica St. Clair, who's on a show called Playing House right now, and who's great. She and I are like a Nichols and May style comedy duo for many years, and we would do a show. We went to Aspen, got agents and managers.
What was it called, the duo?
It was just Manzoukas and St. Clair. We didn't have we didn't have a name or anything like that. But
so you did scripted shit?
Yes, we did.
Well, that was a weird thing that really came out of that whole thing is that people learned how to direct, they learned how to write, they learned how to do sketch.
Yep.
Because it was a full-on community. Everybody played different roles.
And you had to do it for everybody else.
Yeah.
So like I would write and do my shows, but then I directed Seth Morris's one-man show. Everybody would do a part in everything.
He's so fucking funny.
Dude, the funniest.
Right?
Yeah.
I think he's so unsung.
Yeah.
Oh. Somehow.
He has like genuinely some of my all-time favorite characters I've ever seen.
Yeah, we used to do stuff with him on the radio, and then I've had him in my show two different seasons.
Yeah.
He's just too
He's
funny.
The best. He's really, and he's like also like genuinely one of the sweetest, most generous men like in the world.
Yeah.
You know, like it's also like, as opposed to stand-ups, which has its own social kind of understanding, like what was very nice about coming up at UCB was like it's entirely based on support.
Right.
Like the entire ethos of the community
is the big difference.
Supporting each other.
With stand-up, we're all socially
it's
awkward,
pretty, it's pretty mercenary,
broken gypsies.
And while we're full of broken people,
there
is definitely an element of it which is, we're helping each other.
Yeah.
Well, you know, like it's very support based.
But there must be somewhat competitive.
Of course.
Yeah.
Of course.
But still.
And anytime competition was introduced, a guy came from Chicago and started teaching at UCB. Kevin Mullaney was his name. And he started a show called Cage Match, which still exists, where different house teams would go head to head and the audience would vote on the winner.
Right.
Seems easy enough.
I hate that shit.
It fostered such aggressive competition amongst the improv nerds.
Right.
That it like almost like caused schisms
Almost crumbled the whole thing.
It introduced such chaos and such vendettas, and people are still now participating in grudges that exist simply because of one cage match where they felt gypped.
Oh boy.
It's really great. Really funny.
So it takes you a while. So you go to Aspen St. Clair.
Yeah, go to Aspen. We get a deal at Comedy Central.
Did you model it after Nichols and May? I mean, was it? You did.
Very much
You listened to that stuff.
Very much so. I was very into that stuff. Like those records I love.
Compass Players.
Yep.
Yeah.
Really great. And that was very, because they functioned much the same way we did, which was they generated their written material out of improv.
Right.
And so that's what St. Clair and I would do. We would have a regular, like an improv show at the theater, just the two of us, to just improvise.
Yeah.
And then we would record it, or we would improvise just in a room, like in a rehearsal space, record it, and out of that pull stuff that we liked, and then use that as the raw material to write sketches out of.
Uh-huh.
And so that's kind of how we worked, and that's similar to Nichols and May, how they worked.
And you never took any acting lessons.
I did. I did take classes at a certain point. I took classes at the Atlantic Theater Company in New York.
Yeah, that's so
like extension
it's
classes.
It's like antithetical to improv, the Atlantic Theater, in a way. No,
it isn't. It isn't. What I liked, the reason I did it there is because it worked with improv in as much as they weren't focused on any kind of sense memory or any.
Sure,
kind,
it's
none
in
of
the
that.
Script.
It really is. These are the words. Say them.
Yeah.
It is just present tense, living presently.
Yeah.
Which is improv.
Yeah.
You know,
right.
It's just improv with scripted words.
Yeah. Live presently, present tense, presently, but
and
make
also
it up.
Listen.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which is the central like ethos of improv, which is listen.
Yeah.
And that's something that is very hard to do when you are panicking because you don't know what you're gonna say.
Yeah.
But like listening was such a paramount thing. Like when you're like you watch, did you ever watch Wolf Hall?
Uh-uh.
The Mark Rylance show on PBS? Anyway. This show, it's a fine show, but Mark Rylance is like maybe the best actor working currently, just like stone cold genius.
Yeah.
And in the show, he doesn't say a lot, But he's listening constantly. Yeah. And watching him listen is one of the most compelling performances I've ever seen.
Really?
So listening was so paramount. And we'd been like taught to listen for so long that that was very easy to get into at Atlantic. You know? And it was helpful. Like, you know, because at a certain point I was like, ooh, I'm big. I'm too big. Like when I go on auditions, when I get little jobs here and there, I'm just enormous.
Yeah.
Because I'm used to like sketch and improv broad characters.
Yeah.
I need to temper this with reality.
Well, you did that like, I thought that your role in Enlightened, that was a little, like, you know.
I love that role.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I like that show.
Love.
Yeah.
Love that show.
Yeah.
Really amazing.
But you were like a guy, like a real guy.
Regular foreign guy.
Yeah. So you had to learn that. You had to learn how to bring it down.
Very much. And not be always injecting bits or
big funny
lightness or you know, like really just sitting in things.
Sitting with the feelings.
Yeah. Really just existing in moments.
Yeah.
No matter what they are.
Right.
You know? And not worrying about filling silences or spaces or stuff like that was very kind of important for me to learn because I was otherwise predisposed to just fill all the space with clever dialogue.
It seems that the one thing that happens with the improv community is that you all do each other's stuff. So you've been on a million things.
Correct.
For a second or two.
Yeah.
100%. And then you did, but I know that Enlightened was a regular role, right? The League was a regular role.
Sure.
You did a lot and you were able to write on that.
Yep.
And that was a good group of guys.
Great group. Completely improvised show. So it was like, could not be a better show for me and my group of like my peer group who were all on it because it was just our skill set on TV.
Yeah.
So it was so fun.
Right.
That job was beyond fun.
And did they gave you, you got a writing credit just because you were improvising? Did everyone get a writing credit?
No. I got writing credit only on a couple of episodes that I actually wrote the outline for.
Right.
So I play a side character on that show. And then in Success, we introduced my friend, played by Seth Rogen, who's an even more side character.
Yeah.
And then eventually I was like, we would like to do episodes that are just about us. And so every season they would give us a one-off for the adventures of these two monsters.
Right.
So those shows would be full of like drugs and murder on a show that is ostensibly about fantasy football. So it was chaos. And Rogen and I would write those outlines.
Because
that's how the show is structured, as like a 7-page script outline.
And you met him out here?
I met him out here, through like writers' roundtables and stuff like that.
With McKay and those guys?
More with Judd and those guys.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
So you kind of got integrated into this whole world of comedy out here pretty quickly, though.
I stayed in New York much later than a lot of my peer group.
Yeah.
They all moved out here. So when I came out here, they were already kind of set up.
Right.
They were already kind of in the world.
Yeah.
And so it was very easy for me, but I was very lucky in the sense that people were like, they're doing a round table or joke punch up thing. You should come to it. You know, because they knew about it, I would get invited. And then I would get on that list. And so the next time one would come around, I would get invited, you know? And so.
And you're a good guy.
And I'm a good guy.
Yeah,
and
you're excited. Like, I don't know you, but like, you know, you're all filled
up. Anytime we run into each other, it's a delightful conversation.
Yeah, yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I'm always like, there you are.
Yeah.
What are we going to talk?
Still doing it.
But I think some people are difficult, but I think like you not only have talent, but you probably, you know, in a room, you're a
very fun
guy.
Very fun.
Yeah.
Yes. Very fun. And, but also like, I'll pitch jokes, and I'm not afraid to be like, this doesn't work.
Right.
Like, I'm not afraid to be like in those rooms, like, oh, this is a problem. We gotta fix this.
But do you find that, you know, even, you know, outside of the comedy nerd world that you're still like that, there's that guy.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Because
I get a lot of, I hang around a lot with Kroll, and we will get a lot of this, which I enjoy because I like where I am at.
Yeah.
Which is people will be like, oh shit, Nick Kroll.
Yeah.
And Rafi from the League?
Yeah.
And I'm like, great. Don't know my name.
It's better.
Better. Way better.
Yeah.
Way better.
I can have a life.
The thing for me, though, is I am unquestionably me.
Yeah.
Nobody looks at me on the street and is like, is that who I think it is?
Right.
They're like, you're the guy. You're the guy.
But I also think you're that too, give or take, you know, on screen as well, it seems.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, Nick will do some pretty over-the-top shit.
Sure.
But, you know, you stay within your wheelhouse.
I do, for the most part. you know, there are a couple of things here and there that are that I'm diverging from, but yeah, more often than not, I'm playing some version of a maniac, scumbag, drug dealing sociopath monster, like some sort of charming monster is what I'm doing almost all the time.
Well, do you want to do something other than that?
I do, and I have, you know, just not to the same degree of success. You know, like the things that I've done that are more normal parts haven't been in as big a things, you know?
Like what?
Like I'm in a movie called Sleeping With Other People that I think is terrific. And I'm, it's like a romantic comedy. It's like the pitch for it was, it's When Harry Met Sally for Assholes.
Yeah.
And I play Sudeikis. I play like the Bruno Kirby part.
Right.
I'm like Sudeikis' married friend.
Right.
And I've got a wife who's Andrea Savage. And, but we are super funny, bickering, but clearly in love. And we're parents and we're normal people. I'm not a crazy person. I'm like,
is that rewarding?
It's great.
Yeah.
Really fun.
Now, is this one the house, the one that I watched most of?
Nice.
Yes, this morning.
Terrific.
I did, you know.
Great.
It is in the world of those kind of comedies, you know. But is that the, it feels like the biggest part you've had in a movie.
Oh, by far.
I mean, it's like you're half, you're most of the movie.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's, the movie really is, Will, Amy, and I start a casino in my house.
Yeah.
And that's the movie.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
It really is like, it's Casino. It's Joe Pesci, De Niro, and Sharon Stone.
Eventually.
You know, that's what it becomes.
The last third of the
movie.
Exactly.
When it gets violent, it gets pretty crazy.
Yeah, but like, it does.
Yeah.
Like, I don't, you know, it's a weird thing. It seems to be happening recently that the over-the-top violence, that out of nowhere, it gets very,
normal people juxtaposed with hyper-violence.
Right.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's recent though, right?
I think so. I think it's like, it's trying to insert extreme circumstances into what would otherwise be ordinary comedy scenarios. Which, and it's, violence is it's one of the
jarring
places you can go.
Well, yeah, and I think that people have done it before, like, you know, Monty Python has done it before.
Sure.
It's been around before.
Yep.
But there's something about, you know, a big screen movie.
Yeah.
We're just out of nowhere, you know, that...
There's also a thing, though, which is...
Like Sasha's last movie about the soccer guy.
Sure,
what was that called?
Brothers Grimsby.
Were you in that?
No. I was in The Dictator. I was in the one prior.
That was like your big break in a way.
It very much was, yeah.
But the Grimsby movie, like, which I saw at a screening at some small facility, like I was like, whoa, this is over the top. Like some of the violence and some of the sexuality stuff.
What used to be a very well balanced, like, within the first 7 minutes of Beverly Hills Cop, there's a brutal murder.
There's a crazy murder. In the cop movies that used to happen.
In those kind of action comedies of the 80s, violence and comedy are like interchangeable. Like both are being pursued all the time.
Yeah.
To kind of both help the procedural element of the thing and then also the comedy.
But in the 70s and into the 80s a bit, even things that were comedies, people would die.
Right.
Yeah.
And now, I think the reason that violence feels so... crazy, or
it's gone for a while,
because it's gone for a while, and also because it's not being it's a true juxtaposition. The ratio is so off now. The movies now are 90% just comedic, and then every once in a while they sprinkle in 10% of hyper violence just to be like, isn't this crazy?
Well, there's other genres like slasher movies and the horror movies that are just like gratuitous violence that often elevate to comedy, and I think a lot of people maybe not great people think they're hilarious.
Yeah.
Heads coming off and whatnot.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, but it's not my cup of tea. But, like, I watched Analyze This for, like, the 10th time on the plane the other day.
Yeah.
And that's a gangster comedy.
Yeah.
No one goes down.
No.
There's no blood.
No. Nope.
No one dies.
Everybody's fine.
And it's an intentional thing. There's gunplay, but no one
gets hurt.
And that's a decision.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
So now, like, that decision is different.
Oh, totally.
But the weird thing is that I still, maybe it's because I'm old or something, there's some part of me that after everything goes down, that I'm like, well, these people are morally flawed, and they're going to pay for it.
Sure.
But that doesn't happen.
No, it doesn't. Were you expecting like an unhappy 70s ending?
Yeah, I don't know.
This is not a Hal Ashby movie.
There's a point where it's not quite enough that you're running a casino in a suburban neighborhood. Like, I've suspended my disbelief to allow the premise to occur.
That we're basically opening a casino to take all of our friends and neighbors' money and make it ours.
I'm going
to
let that happen. but once, you know, real people get hurt, and I'm like, well, this guy's not a good guy.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, no. You really, if you look too close at it, you're like, wait a minute.
Yeah.
It's the same thing I remember with the dictator talking about it and like doing press for it and stuff and having to be like, oh, well, keep in mind, we're playing terrorists.
Yeah. Right.
Like, we're funny and all this stuff, but like we're playing people that are like bad guys.
Yeah,
you're rooting for bad guys.
Right. Yeah. But you know, you all in this movie, you all have these sort of problems.
Yeah.
You know, yours is a gambling addiction and
totally.
A divorce, and theirs is they got to put their kid through college.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, it's not meant to be an exploration of the human spirit.
No, it is not. No, it is not. And that's the thing. Like, if you get on board for that, if you buy into like, great, they're going to start a casino and they're going to be like,
yeah,
kind of morons and violent people. Great. If you are into it, it's fun.
Well, the other question I had for you was co-wrote Ride Along?
I did. I rewrote Ride Along.
Oh, so you were brought in.
I was brought in. Ride Along was written as a like PG family movie.
Who wrote it?
Greg Coolidge wrote it first.
Right.
And then somebody else wrote a draft of it.
Right.
And then I wrote a draft of it, and then it died.
Okay.
And then years later, what happened was Ice Cube was funny in 21 Jump Street.
Yeah.
And people were like, hey, he could do a comedy. And they were like, we already have it. It's this.
Yeah.
And so they took my script. When I wrote it, they asked it that it be for, it was him, and they wanted Andy Samberg to be the guy.
Right.
The Kevin Hart part.
Yeah.
And so I wrote it for them, for those two. And then when it came back to life, I had nothing to do with it, but they used my draft and just rewrote all the stuff for Kevin.
Right.
New guys rewrote it.
Yeah.
But because it was my draft that it was based off of, I got credit.
Well, that must have been good.
It was great.
Yeah.
It was great. And a lot of my stuff was structurally the movie, you know, and a lot of the jokes are my stuff. But those guys did a great, Manfredi and Hay did an amazing job, you know, rewriting it for Cube and Kevin, which was great.
Well, why is that the only thing you've written?
I've written other stuff. I'm one of those people that for many years like would sell a show, would write a pilot would get made, not picked up.
Right.
There's a lot of those.
Right.
Like the last 12 years of my life are riddled with those.
What about movies?
Movies. I'm writing a movie right now for Paramount. I've written a bunch of other movies similarly, some of which have just sat and not been made. Nothing else has been made.
Yeah.
Sat and not been made are still in process.
Yeah.
Like I've got a movie that I wrote for Imagine that I'm supposed to direct and blah, blah, blah. But it's like getting comedy features made is very weird right now.
Yeah.
Unless it's like
and you
some
don't mind
big high concept
the limbo or doing the work and having it sit there?
It is. I used to mind it a lot more earlier when I had nothing else going on.
Right.
And now I don't, and it's not that I don't mind it, but now I recognize that there is a constant state of flux in everything.
Yeah.
And so I now am like, I have my eggs in many baskets.
Sure.
So if it takes 2 years for this movie to get made, if at all.
Right.
At the very least, I'll have done these three things in that 2 years.
Well, yeah. And you're working all the time. Do you still actually teach improv?
I don't.
No.
I don't anymore. I haven't since I moved here. Really.
Not even a special seminar here and there?
No, that'd be fun though.
Do you do it?
I do. Yeah, every week.
I do
a show every week at UCB here on Franklin.
Someone told me they saw you do the best improv they ever saw in their life.
Really?
Yeah, it was apparently it was entirely silent.
Oh, I know that show. Yeah.
That you did a 45-minute completely silent improv.
Alone.
Alone.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was supposed to do a show with three other people.
Yeah.
All three of them didn't show up.
Right.
And I was like, what am I going to do? I kind of was like, I don't know. This, you know, I've done it I've done shows in the past where I've just pulled random people out of the audience and done a show with them.
Yeah.
And this show in particular, the idea of it is there's no edits.
Right.
So it's just one long scene usually. It just happens to be with more people.
Right.
So I was like, you know what? It'd be cool. I'll do it alone. You know, why not? I've never done that, you know, and because at this point, improvising, like, that's arguably the place I feel most comfortable in life is on stage, not knowing what's going to happen.
Right.
It's the only time I'm not crippled with anxiety about the future or riddled with regrets about the past. Like,
you have that?
I'm just like present tense.
But do you really live in that zone?
Off the stage?
Off stage,
I live in a less regrets about the past, although they're there. like hyper anxious future catastrophic future thinker.
Yeah.
Like I am
dread.
Like, dread.
Yeah, I have
fear
that.
And dread.
About all things? Like coming over here?
No, not coming over here. No. More
end of the world?
More like I'm very susceptible to like health concerns. I'm very obsessed with I'm like hypochondriacal in many ways. Oh yeah, totally. Like when you went to the bathroom,
yeah.
I secretly took Clorox wipes out of my bag and washed my hands.
Oh yeah,
like just cause.
Yeah,
it had been a while.
My bathroom is a little dirty.
No, just cause I'm like
yeah, brrr, really.
Like I'm just like constantly cycling. My mind is constantly cycling.
Yeah, but what do you do to stop it? Improvise. Yeah, but I mean,
or
like,
I've been trying to meditate. I've been trying to do all of those kind of mindfulness exercises to kind
is
of
it working.
In fits and starts, honestly,
because I have comes that too. Goes. I have the paralyzing anxiety and dread.
Yeah,
and
for me, catastrophic thinking.
Yeah, but you seem capable of experiencing happiness.
Yeah, to some degree or another.
Yeah,
I'm good at representing that I'm capable of experiencing happiness. For me,
so you're a professional.
Yeah. For me, like even here as we talk,
yeah.
I am still performing a persona that seems vulnerable.
Yeah,
you know what I mean.
Yeah.
Like, and I'm aware of that, yeah. And I'm aware of like, you know, like I was having a conversation with my therapist recently, and was like, because she was like, I was trying to explain the idea of a comedic persona,
uh-huh.
And a comedic persona that looks a lot like I look.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, and she was like, I guess I don't know what you mean. I was like, oh, I'm going to have to send you something because I have like the most naked conversational relationship with her.
Yeah.
And I was like, I'm going to have to send you something that is representative of who I otherwise am.
Yeah.
Because you don't actually know that version of me that I would otherwise talk about.
Wait, so when you're with her, you're like wringing your hands?
I'm much more like, I'm much more forthcoming. I'm much more vulnerable. I'm much more laid bare.
Yeah.
Like there is no, I have no walls, you know, with her. Because to me, I'm like vigilantly pursuing like growth and understanding with her in my mind. I'm like, the faster you and I connect on this, the better, the quicker I'm going to get out of my head.
But it doesn't work that way necessarily.
No,
only in that moment.
Yeah.
And then you walk out feeling like, oh, we really did it.
Yeah. And then I open my phone and I'm like, fuck.
So you're that guy. You're the guy that, you know, there's probably a couple women who are like, oof.
Yeah. Yeah.
They're out there. I love them, but I had to get out.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
No, it's no good. It's no good. You know, women who are like, I'm rooting for you, but like, it's no good. You got to figure it out, bro.
I'm exhausted.
Exhausted is what they would all say.
Right. Yeah.
It's exhausting.
Yeah.
It's so exhausting to fight with you.
So you just spin around.
Yeah.
You know, like in variations of dread, anger, and sadness.
Fear, sad, melancholy. I'm prone to fits of melancholy.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Well, it seems like all that stuff. So you're sort of like, I mean, I can relate to that in the sense that you just keep throwing yourself into shit.
Oh, yeah.
To challenge it. Well, yeah, to challenge it and to defy it.
Yeah.
And like that's the thing about dread. But even as you said earlier that you know that you did all these things, you took all these chances, and you know certain things aren't frightening, but there's still this core thing. What the fuck is that? So like, if you say to me like, well, I was put in prison and I did this thing. I mean, obviously it was limited to what it was. But so a lot of things, you know, post the experience of having a meltdown, which now that you tell me what you're really like in an hour and a half in, that in Morocco, that must have been like
I really was like, I got to figure out how to be truthful and honest without just being like totally.
Right. But so you must have really been freaking out in Morocco.
Truly. I was like weeping on the street,
right.
Like catastrophic mess.
All alone out there.
Alone.
So you got through that, but in the same way with me is like, okay, so you know you catalog that experience and it should represent something that will propel you to be less fearless in life. But the fear is not about getting up on stage or doing the things that is so frightening to other people. It's just the quiet of being alone with your own brain.
Being alone, period. You know, like, I feel like, the thing that is, like, the my nightmares, like, the nightmares that I wake up, like, that I can't shake are nightmares of loneliness.
Yeah.
Are truly just, I am alone. I am alone in a place that I don't know. I'm alone in the world. I'm, like, I'm a pariah. I'm a, like, those are the things, inescapable
or
loneliness.
Or invisible. Yeah. That's what I get.
Oh, interesting.
It's sort of like, if I'm alone too long, it's sort of like, I regress to this point where, where I'm just sort of like, no one knows
Do I
me.
Exist?
Yeah, yeah. Not quite like that, but just sort of like, you know, you start to forget that you experience yourself in relation to, right? Other people, an audience or whatever.
Well, it's a very narcissistic thing of like, for me, I'll be like, if I don't hear from a friend for a little while, I'll text them and be like, are you mad at me?
Oh, yeah.
And I just don't know it.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's better. I go right to fuck you sometimes. You know.
It's been a week.
You go fuck yourself.
Yeah. But then, then you've constructed an entire thing.
That doesn't exist at all. They're like, I'm sorry, my dog was sick.
Exactly.
I'm like, oh, okay.
Yeah, I'm going through some stuff. You could like just reach out and ask me how I'm doing.
Right. It is a selfish thing.
Yeah.
I'm filtering it too often. Yeah.
I'm filtering it through me. Right. So, I haven't heard from my friend in a while. I must have done something. It must be me, rather than like they've got something going on.
And then you reach out and immediately make it about you.
Yeah,
I don't know what I did, but I hope we're okay.
Hey, I hope we're cool. You know, I don't know. Maybe last time did I say something? Right, or you know, and they're always like, no, you know, my dad is sick. I'm going through something, and I'm like, fuck, I'm the asshole.
I'm an idiot.
It's like, you're supposed to talk to me more.
Right. Yeah. How are we gonna get better?
Yeah. We're doing it, right? We're just middle-aged men figuring it out.
I guess.
Like having...
Do you have a wife or children?
I do not. I have neither.
Yeah, so I don't either. Yep. So are we figuring it out?
You have a... You know, sounds like, just as a fan of the show, it sounds like a very successful relationship right now.
Yeah, we're doing good.
Great.
But like, I don't think I'm going to have kids.
Yep.
I think that's done. And, you know, I have...
You think that's done because decided you don't want kids. Well, like, certainly could still have kids. Steve Martin had a kid when he was like 72 years old.
Who did?
Steve Martin.
Yeah, I know.
I mean, a million people had kids when they were older.
I don't want to be that guy.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like I'm going to be old. I'm almost tired already.
Does she?
Well, not really. She doesn't, you know? Yeah. But like, you know, I don't have the answers to those things that, you know, sustain relationships in a healthy way.
Sure.
That, you know, that where the compromises are okay.
Yeah.
And that, like, you know, because I get to that anxiety place, or I get to that. It's not even like it could be better or it could be worse. It's just sort of like, is this it?
Yeah.
Is this it?
Yeah. Or is this it? Or I get, am I doing it right?
Yeah.
Am I doing this right?
I know I'm doing it wrong.
Yeah. And then that knowledge is like insidious. When you start understanding that you're doing it wrong and that the system you've created is itself flawed in a way that can only destroy the thing that you are trying to make.
And then when you have this conversation with them.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah. And then they're like, why are you so intellectual about it?
Yeah.
And I'm like, well, I'm trying to figure this out like it's a problem that we're gonna figure out rather than just being with you and finding a way to do it together.
Can't improvise in life, huh?
Truly. I mean, and I talk about this constantly.
Oh, really?
I am the best at a thing performatively that I am incapable of living in my life. I am an amazing improviser.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a very arrogant thing to say, but I am a very good improviser.
You've been doing it long enough
I've been doing it very long. I'm very good at it.
Right.
And it is living in the listening, living in the moment, and accepting only the enough responsibility for that which you can provide in that scene on stage or whatever.
Right.
Which is, by the way, a great model for living your life.
Sure.
I'm only responsible for that which I can provide to this person or this event or this in my life.
Yeah.
Incapable of doing that. In life, I'm like, I must be responsible for you and your happiness.
Yeah.
I'm in my mind during this being like, is this a good episode?
Yeah.
I don't know. Is Mark gonna be happy about this? Or is he gonna, what's the intro gonna be like? Is he gonna be like, I sat with Jason Manzoukas, good guy. You know, good guy. But you know what? We didn't really get into it at the very end. Tricky, he's a tricky guy. Didn't get interesting till the end. We talked about music, we talked about this, that, and the other. I don't know, he's okay.
No, that's what I would say to my producer right after the show.
Yeah.
I wouldn't intro you like that. I have the same issue, like, you know, having these conversations in here.
Yeah.
I don't have a fucking social life.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, my chick's, you know, she's painting over there. We go out to eat and it's okay.
Well, I never see you around except at music shows, which I like.
Well, yeah, I go to some music shows when I get tickets or I'm invited, but I don't make way to do it. But like, you know, like I get to the point where people don't ask me to go to things really. And I guess there are premieres and things I should go to, but I don't know. But I used to go out more to the clubs and stuff. And then like lately I've just been like, I think I'm through the woods with that shit.
Well, none of it's, I mean, you should go to what you want to go to.
I just don't always know what that is. And the dread will paralyze me.
Because like for me, I'm like, if I want to see a movie early, I'll go to the premiere if I can.
Yeah.
You know, just to be like, because I want to see that movie.
Well,
like,
I just saw yours on a screener.
Yeah, great. Yeah. By the way, great.
Yeah.
You know, by the way, thank you for watching it. Yeah. You know, in and of itself, you know, a feat. To get people to watch stuff. But there's also just too much.
There's too much, but also, like, that's the big problem. Like, don't you ever ask
yourself... And LA is a home-based life.
No, I know. I know that. Yeah, I was just in New York, but I get exhausted there, too, and I travel around the same four blocks in
same
New York.
Restaurants,
the same fucking restaurants.
Yep.
And I'm beating myself up now, because now...
Do you go up when you're out there?
I do sometimes, but I didn't this last time, because I've been on the road for months, and I just shot a special, and there's some part of me that I want to try to feel... Like, I don't have to do it.
Sure.
And I don't know, like, I don't
and
know.
And it can be all of it. Like, you don't have to participate in all of it.
Right.
You know, in terms of what you're saying about going to premieres or going to the parties or blah, blah, blah. Who cares?
No one asks me to go. No one invites me to fucking dinner.
Nobody asks anybody to go. Everybody's just like, I got to go to things. I want to go to there.
I always feel like there's a list.
Oh, my God. This is so funny. I love it that we are still not believing that people want us around. You're doing exactly what I just said, which is like, are you mad at me?
What, you do it?
Yeah, I do it too. Of like, should I feel insulted that I wasn't invited to X, Y, or Z?
Yeah, and then you don't want to go to begin with.
Yeah, I don't, and then, because I will say that sometimes to like my manager, who's a good friend of mine or something, I'll be like, is it weird that I wasn't invited to this, that, or the other?
Yeah.
And she'll be like, do you want to go to it? I'm sure we can call. And I'll be like,
that's a thing.
No, I don't want to go to it. I just feel like, should I have been invited or not?
Well, then you start to realize like all those people are just sort of like, I need to go to
like,
that.
We're middle-aged men. Like, we should not care about that.
I know.
Like, we're not
I'm
only-
very close to not caring.
Also, not only are we middle-aged men and we shouldn't care, like, we're doing plenty.
Yeah.
Yeah. We're plenty busy. We're doing plenty.
I'm on the precipice of not giving a fuck.
Great.
You?
Great.
No.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And certainly about the like social kind of nonsense like that.
Do you know what you like to do like outside of work?
Yeah. I'm like a real creature of habit in that sense. Like I want to do, but it's very like, especially if it's like I'm going to New York. I want to go to the record stores that I want to go to. Like,
I
have
I
like
that
errands
too. I do
to
that
run
too.
Almost.
I do that too.
And I just want to walk around.
Restaurants. Yeah, restaurants. I do that. Yeah.
I've got all those things, stores that I want to buy
but
clothes
But it's comforting,
in.
Right? But
Super.
Then,
it's like, it's all soothing.
Right. But then out of the box, I'm sort of like, I want to go Lincoln Center. I did one experience there years ago where I just stepped in and just saw a symphony. I didn't know nothing about it.
Same happened to me with, and you had her on your show. I heard something about Annie Baker's play, The Flick.
Right.
And so I happened to be in New York and was like, I'm going to go see that. So I went and like my mind was blown. I became obsessed with her.
Right. That's the thing we got to keep doing is blowing our minds, I guess.
Well, that is what's hard about, I think, about Los Angeles versus New York is New York makes it very easy for you to like just do a thing. Like truly like improvise your day and night. Like that's why I love New York because it's
you don't go to like three or four places and you get there and you're like, why is that person still hanging around? Is there someone to tell that person to go home?
Oh, get that guy out of here. Really? Okay. Is this what we're doing?
Yeah. All right.
Fair
that
enough.
Doesn't happen in New York.
No. No, but like in LA, you really are like limited. Mm. You're in a night or a weekend, you're maybe doing two things.
How's the meditation working?
It's okay.
Yeah.
It's okay. It's on me. Yeah. It's on me to do it more.
When was the last time you went to the doctor?
Oh, recently.
Yeah.
I go to the doctor constantly. Oftentimes so that he can be like, you're fine. It's nothing.
Isn't that weird? Now, like, I know where that comes from with me. Like, did your parents not make you feel better?
Here's what it is for me. And I think this is what it is for me is, and forgive me, you know, for talking about this food allergy again, but I think because I was raised so acutely aware of my own mortality.
Yeah.
Because it was so present. I never felt invincible. I never was a child.
If you ate an egg, you'd die?
If I ate anything that has egg in it, if I eat pasta, if I eat bread, if I eat anything for breakfast, if I eat anything that has egg as an ingredient, I'll die. I have the same allergy to eggs that people have to, like,
almonds,
bee stings, or oh. nuts, or whatever.
Really? Like your throat will close?
Yeah. Like EpiPen in my bag, like anaphylaxis, the whole thing. And as a result, like, very, like, parents very afraid of for me, and very afraid to, like, let go of
right,
me.
Right,
made
right.
me very not trusting of people, not like very, like, fear-based kind of, like, if you leave this house, don't eat anything anybody gives you.
Right.
Don't believe anybody that tells you it doesn't have egg. Like, very, like, rigid. My
right.
pediatrician, the pediatrician was like, it was all fear-based.
Yeah.
You will die. I remember him very vividly being like, I had a boy who had your same allergy, and he wanted to have a piece of pizza, and he ate it, and he died.
Oh my God.
And I remember so vividly being the piece of pizza, because I was like, I like pizza.
Yeah.
I want to eat pizza.
How did you know you liked it?
Because there was a place in my town that didn't have egg okay. in the pizza. Anyway, but I think for me, like, that idea of the incredible, how vulnerable I was
yeah.
made me feel like doctors know all the answers, and I'm just fundamentally weak and fragile.
Right.
And as a result, if this is possible, maybe everything's possible.
Right.
So I will, like, read an article or hear an NPR story about, like, a meningitis outbreak.
Yeah.
And I'll text my doctor and be like, do I need to be worried about this?
Do you manifest symptoms?
Constantly.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. And I'll tie things together. Yeah. Once I notice one thing,
oh yeah,
I'll systematically sure. go sure. like top to bottom and be like, yeah. what else is up?
Yeah.
What
yeah.
else is up?
It's all connected.
Yeah.
And then you can go connect the dots on the Google.
Yep. Or the biggest mistake was... Biggest mistake was my doctor let me have his cell phone number so yeah. I can text him.
Oh.
My doctor, who, upon first meeting him, as I was going through all the medical issues that I've had through my life, looked up in the middle of it and goes, wow, you really got a bum unit.
Yeah.
He goes, and then he was the same doctor as a friend of mine who was like, and my friend at one point goes, I don't think he should have said this to me, but I was like, hey, you're also seeing Jason Mantzoukas. And yeah. the doctor goes, oh, yeah. That guy's got so many problems. He should be dead by now. I'm shocked he's still alive. And Rob was like, I don't think he should be saying that to other people.
But it's mental issues, right?
You know? Physical, like real physical stuff.
You do?
Yeah. I mean, like various, but like, right. yeah, you know, just stuff.
Yeah. All right. Well, that's, so you're in a constant state of panic.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm on the verge of a constant state of panic.
Yeah.
You know, I'm in like a medium
right
state
there.
Of panic.
It's always right there.
It's like
though.
A full glass, and like everything is just hovering to like pour but, more
but,
into
but
it.
But all it takes is a pimple or yep. something on your skin.
Oh
or,
my God. Yeah, the frequency
ringing in the ear.
The frequency with which I go to my dermatologist to be like, what is this?
Yeah.
What is this? Is this skin cancer?
Yeah.
What's going on?
Yeah.
And that she's like, it's a pimple or it's a hair follicle.
Right. Well, I don't know, like, you know, I was able to sort of get that shit in check somehow, because the core of it for me was not the same as yours. I don't know. How do you think you get that in check?
Don't know.
No. Improvise.
Right? Yeah. And truly, like, that's like trying to be more, allow for more of a present improvised narrative in how I live my life
yeah.
is what I'm trying to do.
Yeah.
But it goes against everything that I've built
yeah,
structurally.
Yeah, because it's really long form.
Yeah. It's like the show's hopefully not going to end for a long time.
Exactly.
And the connections are going to be amazing.
Yeah, yeah. You just don't know where they're going to come from, who the players are. Well, it was great talking to you,
This
buddy.
Was a delight.
Thanks, man.
Thanks for having me.
So that was lovely. I really like that guy. I don't feel like playing guitar today because I'm hot, I'm sweaty, I've done two interviews, and I've done this today. I'm a little shattered, all right? Boomer lives!